Aren't you a technology supplier looking for deal flow? Then you should try our new platform, Connect. It's designed to help buyers and brands find the best tech solutions to match their campaign requirements. It's free for buyers to use and for tech suppliers to set up an account and start applying to campaign briefs. Set up your account today by visiting exchangewire.com/connect or email us at info@thewirecorp.com.
The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the MadTech Podcast. I'm Matt Broughton, Senior Editor at ExchangeWire, and my goodness me, do we have an Easter treat lined up for you all, because we've got an extended team podcast ready for you to listen to while eating your chocolate eggs and having a tea on Easter Sunday morning. From left to right on my screen as we're looking, we've got Anne-Marie, our Director of Global Partnerships.
Good morning, everyone.
We've got Rachel Smith, COO ExchangeWire.
Hello.
We have Lindsay Roundtree, Head of Content.
Hi there.
And Kieran O'Kane, CEO.
Hello. Happy Easter to you all. Happy COVID Easter.
Very Easter bunny-like, Kieran.
Yeah, Easter, not an Easter bunny. I don't look like a bunny rabbit. More like...
Oh, Emery's got an Easter bunny. A pug.
Bigfoot.
Easter bunny.
Yes, special Easter wishes from Ireland. Ma Sheedy sent that over.
That's nice.
Yeah.
Were there some reciprocal card arrangements going on there?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. I had to keep the mantelpiece busy after Mother's Day. You know, she takes it about an extra week to take them down.
Amazing.
Brilliant. Kicking right up onto our first story of the week. WPP's Media Investment Division Group M have revised their forecast for growth in the UK's advertising market in light of what they deemed a shaky first quarter of 2021 and the ongoing uncertainty around Brexit. The firm now expects the market to grow by 12.6%, which is marginally higher than a 12.4% estimate they published in December, which is thanks largely to digital advertising driven by small and medium-sized businesses. Now, the modest rise reflects the UK's cautious optimism over Q1, spurred by the success of the vaccination rollout, and takes into account the IMF's prediction of a 4.5% growth in the economy, which is largely powered by the further easing of restrictions. However, since the UK has spent most of Q1 under strict lockdown measures, Group M predicts that the advertising market will be relatively soft. Whilst the short-term impacts of the pandemic and Brexit can be quantified, it's less clear how the market will fare in the long term. Group M's predictions, however, are rather pessimistic in that they forecast a stall in innovation as a result of shortfalls in capital and lower risk appetites, particularly among the small businesses. The firm also anticipates that the financial support implemented by governments has dulled recipient companies' resilience, meaning that many will struggle to deal with the sudden shock of these schemes being withdrawn. Yet Group M also acknowledges that the creativity and adaptability sparked by COVID could serve to cushion some companies against the removal of the government support and prove positive in the long run. So there's several things to distill in here in terms of whether you think the vision is accurate, whether you think it's significant, and also whether you agree with that, whether the ad market could be in for a nasty shock when furlough and other financial support schemes end. So Lindsay, what are your thoughts on this one?
Oh, I'm in the hot seat. Wonderful. Thanks for that, Matt. I think that we've talked about Group M forecasts quite a few times in the podcast over the years since I started them. And I think that they are naturally fit on the more pessimistic side. I think they raise some valid points, certainly around, you know, there's a lot of financial support happening in the UK at the moment. And when that financial support ends, and it's due to end in what, June, September, there's going to be a massive shock to the system. And there's a lot of money floating around at the moment. People have got that sweet, sweet furlough money that they are using to spend on various things. There's going to be a big shock when they don't have that anymore. But I think at the same time, there's been massive saving going on. So from that perspective, we can probably expect a boost, particularly as the world starts opening up, as our country starts opening up over the next sort of few weeks and months. I'm excited about that. One thing that I picked up on was the notion that there might be reduced innovation as a result of the pandemic. And I feel the opposite. Maybe... What the report actually says is around smaller businesses not having the capacity to innovate. And maybe that's true. But I think that there's been a lot of innovation for businesses, particularly around digital media. First of all, because necessity is the mother of invention, and there's been a lot of reasons why they've had to innovate. They've had to transform themselves digitally to cope with what the pandemic has brought upon them. Just the pandemic itself. But on top of that, you've also got things like, you know, cookie-less world and IDFA-less world and what they're doing. So there's had to be more innovation around that. So from that perspective, I'm actually very excited about some of the things that have happened for businesses, particularly kind of marketers over the past year. And I think that there's a lot, you know, you speak to marketers at the moment, there's a lot of exciting stuff they're working on. And there's a lot for them to navigate at the moment, not just from a marketing team perspective, but from an entire business and how marketing fits in with that wider business portfolio. So for me, that is interesting. And I think that looking at the forecasts that they predict for kind of the next few years, I think that it's clear that the internet is definitely the one that the thing that is holding, keeping a baseline for media investment more generally. But we are going to see a massive boost in audio. We're going to see a massive boost in out of home this year. Cinemas can take a long time to recover. But I think particularly from a digital perspective, audio and out of home are going to be very exciting channels to look at. And I think that we're going to see, a lot more advertising happening in TV, where TV advertising has dropped because businesses haven't had the budget to advertise. I think there's going to be a huge boost there. So I'm excited about what it shows. I'll be interested to see how accurate those forecasts actually end up being for when we look at Q1 and then Q2 numbers.
Awesome. Optimism over pessimism then.
Absolutely. Someone's got to be optimistic.
Amory, what are your thoughts on this one?
I found the SME angle quite interesting because looking at some numbers, there are about 6 million private businesses in the UK at the start of 2020, and almost 100% of those have less than 250 employees. So if you take into account that they account for 52% of private sector turnover in 2020 and 60% of all private sector jobs in the UK, that's a massive area that I think has been overlooked and continues to be overlooked, but hopefully that will change. Mm-hmm. For me, there's absolutely no mistake that SMEs are crucial to the UK's economy, and it's good that this kind of the current situation has shone a bit of a light on that. And I think their contribution is just going to increase year on year. So I, with regards to the kind of the nasty shock when furlough and other financial support comes to an end, I hope that's not the case because they've got time, you know, to prepare. And as Lindsay said, you know, it's a time for innovation. And I think that there is more of a reason to be optimistic. And I also think that it's a prime time for these organizations to kind of build confidence. They've gone through a tough 12 months, like a lot of organizations globally, but it's perhaps given them the encouragement to feel more optimistic. And in reality, the creative ideas that they've got, it's a time that we can, you know, our industry exudes those, and that doesn't go any differently for the small to medium enterprises. And I think it's their opportunity to turn them into reality. And that is through the various channels that Lindsay talked about. So whilst I'm not in a position to kind of, I don't feel I can confidently qualify whether or not the revision is accurate or not, I do think that they can be more optimistic.
Awesome. So similar themes of optimism there. Kieran, what are your thoughts on this one?
You will see sort of like a sport and economic activity post the easing of lockdown, which means more money will be spent in the economy, which means probably more marketing will spend in the economy. And I agree with both Lindsay and Amory about other channels sort of like becoming sort of like, you know, lively again, so to speak. Like an out of home has probably been, if I was an out of home marketer, I would have stopped at most of that during COVID. So you're going to see channels like that really being activated. In terms of the business collapse, I mean, look, I think the furlough thing might affect some businesses at the end of furlough, and there may be some job losses. But the reality is, the the food industry will come back fairly quickly. If demand is there, people will find a way to kind of like get back. Like, you know, money will be lent to the system. Businesses will come back on stream. But, you know, I think that the economy will sort of will grow this year significantly if we can get. It's all dependent on COVID, on the vaccination being rolled out. Like, you know what I mean? The US is like nearly 30 to 40% vaccinated now, and they're basically pumping serious money into their economy through Biden's infrastructure plan, which I believe is about going to be $4 trillion, which is going to really fire up the economy. But remember that there's pent-up demand from consumers, right? We've been effectively incarcerated for the better part of 2 years. There's going to be an appetite to do traveling, to eat more, to be out. So we're going to spend more money. And if most people have been lucky enough not to lose their jobs during this period, they will be gagging to spend money, and that's good for the economy, and obviously that's good for marketing. So it all has a cumulative effect. What I'm worried about is 2 years down the line when there's a reality check about how much money we've printed to support this, and debt needs to be paid back, and we have to start slashing various parts of the government spending, taxes go up, and that's when the chickens come home to roost in the middle of the decade. Like, but it's party time for the next few years.
From optimism to party time, it's all going uphill. Rachel, what are your thoughts on this one?
Oh yeah, party time for sure. I mean, Kieran raises a good point that that we have to expect in a couple of years' time the impact of this to be maybe felt a little more across the board in terms of income tax raises, but also corporation tax increases. We know that the UK government's got plans to do that, right? So to not repeat what others have said, which I agree with the points that everybody's raised, I think perspectives that I could offer in addition to that is that one thing we talked about at the beginning of the pandemic was the notion that it would give rise to this sort of low-touch economy and businesses that are focused on anything that isn't, an in-person transaction will do well. Of course, we've seen that kind of filter through in the advertising and marketing industry, where marketers have spent money to advertise in online environments. And so anyone that works in digital advertising and marketing has seen the upside of that. But I wonder if actually what we're at the beginning of, and this links to the point about innovation, is a significant change in our economic landscape in general, and that we will start to see some serious innovation around industries that have been high touch before in the past, either being regenerated to become low touch or being overtaken by lower touch industries. And so I think one of the sectors that they mentioned that's particularly impacted by all of the restrictions associated with the pandemic, and unfortunately may also well be impacted by supply chain issues connected to Brexit, are things like hospitality and, high street retail. We know that certainly high street retail's, going through a massive transformation, and hospitality might change a little bit as well. The desire for people to go out and to socialise with one another, I don't think will change, but maybe the ways in which we do that will change. And so maybe that will give rise to some other industries and some other technology focused solutions that will help to kind of grow that SME sector that Anne-Marie was talking about. I can't call you Anne-Marie, I'm afraid. I have to call you AMS. It's just really Anne-Marie. Yeah.
It's a long word for you, I know.
Yeah, it is a long word. It's far too long. So there's that. There's also I certainly agree with everyone that there's definitely ought to be some more optimism around spending, because I think people who haven't lost their jobs have probably saved a bit of money, and there'll be definitely be pent up demand, and they'll also, there's consumer savings are in a good position, the best position they've been in for a very long time in this country. So it'll be interesting to see the impact of that once restrictions loosen and people can move around and start spending that money. I think the other thing is that we've got absolutely no idea what the impact of Brexit will be. And, the Group M, forecast says that we can maybe make some assumptions about the short term, but the long term, we're still in the dark over that. And we expect that the sectors that's really going to impact are things like manufacturing and supply chain. So maybe that won't have an enormous impact on, advertising and marketing, the wider advertising and marketing industry, but we just don't know what that's going to look like in the UK. And maybe that's one of the reasons for a little bit of, cautious optimism from Group M. The other thing about Brian's summaries, which I love, by the way, a regular reader of them, they're very, he's he's got a financial analyst background. And so he's taking on board so many different sources. It's sometimes difficult to work out exactly, not because he's not explicit about the sources that he's using, but it's sometimes difficult to marry his predictions with what we experience, I think, in our day-to-day lives. So I'm going to go with, I think we could afford to be a bit more optimistic than Group M. I'm not quite at the party yet with Ciaran. Of course, he's already attended the party and is now in the hangover phase worrying about what's happening in 2 years' time.
Fair enough. Well, you know, hopefully the Exchange Y view of optimism is the one that plays out rather than the Group M view of, yeah, things are going to go a bit downhill. Moving on to our second story. Facebook could save their reputation and soul by becoming a B corporation, writes Brett Hurt in TechCrunch. The Data World, which is itself a CEO, CEO and co-founder, asserts that changing their business model to one that strives to empower social causes will help the maligned social media giant mend their relationship with their users and the wider public. With a greater and more widespread recognition of the social harm caused by the social by the shareholder value maximization ideology that companies such as Facebook employ, ditching the practice will become inevitable for survival, argues Hurt. Conscious capitalism and B corporations are on the rise, and the World Economic Forum are promoting a fourth sector that treats purpose as equal to profit. With even BlackRock CEO Larry Fink acknowledging that the world's largest investment firm should seek to benefit the world and not just an elite group of shareholders, Facebook must recognize that they should do the same, at least according to Hurt. The US-based tech behemoth has fallen out of favor with regulators and consumers alike for a litany of misdeeds, from tax avoidance to failing to clamp down on misinformation and hate speech. Revelations surrounding their treatment of user data surfaced amidst the 2016 Cambridge Analytica scandal, and their controversial campaign tactics used by former US President Donald Trump are prime examples of this. While Facebook have attempted to salvage their image with commitments to tackle dubious content, an irreversible recognition of the threat the platform currently poses to democracy and societal well-being make these efforts almost pointless. Yet transforming the company into a public benefit corporation could potentially give Facebook a chance to start anew and offer real value to users, says Hurt. So quite a few things to distill here, whether, you know, Facebook could realistically make a change. If they did make their change, would it be a cynical attempt just to, you know, garner more public favor? And also, you know, would it make Facebook a bit more easy to regulate? So I'm very interested to hear your thoughts on these.
What's a B corporation?
They put purpose over profit. So they balance them together.
We are talking about Facebook here, you know that.
This is exactly the thing.
I knew Ciaran was going to not even wait to be introduced.
Why would TechCrunch write? What is the problem with these news tech sites that they are just navel gazing? Who cares about Facebook? Facebook are beyond redemption.
Yeah, you cannot become a B Corp, I can't even say the fucking word, you cannot become a B Corp and then expect to right all of your previous wrongs, of which there are plenty. Not going to happen.
Yeah.
I used to be a B-boy, did body popping for a while, but I wasn't very good at it and I stopped. So I don't see how Facebook could become a B Corp if I can't become a B-boy.
I mean, principally, they would also need to find, another revenue source, right? They make all of their revenue from advertising. So I'd just be interested to see how they could hold up to the standard of B corporations, which, if you look for a definition, is supposed to be companies that adhere to the highest standards of verified social and environmental performance, public transparency. I'm just going to repeat that bit. Public transparency and legal accountability to balance profit with purpose. I just can't see it.
Mark Zuckerberg's a sociopath. He doesn't care about people. I mean, the man is beyond redemption. Like, that's my 2 pence worth there, Matt. I just, that's a laughable story. Is this April Fool's? It is April Fool's, isn't it?
Like, oh, maybe.
Nice one, Matt. You got us there.
Zing.
It's true, though. If you think, like, surely founders start a business with an intent, and I really don't believe this was it.
So, I don't think 100%.
What are you saying, AMS?
I think everyone deserves a second chance. That's another way of looking at it, or a third chance or a fourth chance, depending how big your bank balance is with these guys. But if it's going to change, then are they suggesting that they're going to undo their original intentions? And if that's the case, then are they actually going to restructure and put people who are genuinely mindful or empathetic and driven by good in charge of the business? Because they have to kind of rip it all up and start again. And who are they doing it for? Who uses Facebook now? Okay, I'm on there. I'm not active. Definitely over the past year, probably not good for my mental health, looking at stuff that I did even this morning, you know, a nice memory. This time last year, I was cruising down the Mekong River. Do I want to see that? No, another reason for me to get off it. But is it that they're trying to influence Gen Z because they've got more influence and purchasing power in the market?
I don't think, I think Facebook's chasing, the good thing about Facebook.com is that it's a decaying property, right? It's trying everything to keep itself relevant. And the younger generation are a bit more conscious of the world. And it feels so wrong. I find it very creepy that Mark Zuckerberg would start becoming a lovable, caring about the world type of person, when he's probably been responsible for the decay of democracy in the Western world over the last 10 years. Like, he's definitely facilitated the advent of some of the most horrible autocratic leaders we've seen in our lifetimes. Had it not been for the ability of a woman in Georgia to canvass non-hick, non-racist votes, it could have been a second term of that orange clown, and we don't know where we'd be in 4 years' time, thankfully. But he's, you know, I find these stories to be completely irrelevant. Well, but
hold on just 1 second, because connected to what AMS just said, actually, if you look at the TechCrunch story, the author is saying that he's arguing that there is a sort of a global move towards businesses with more of a sound moral compass and a sound moral proposition. And that the argument, furthermore, is that consumers are starting to move that way too. So if you look at some companies who are already B corporations, and some of them are owned by, you know, subsidiaries are subsidiaries of the likes of Unilever and other companies, other big, you know, FMCGs. Most of them are companies that you know are either pushing and promoting organic products, or, you know, doing something that's sort of environmentally based. They've got very sound social and environmental purposes. And the author is saying this isn't a phase, it's not a fad, it's not going to be a trend that slows down. It's going to grow and gather pace because our entire lives have changed so significantly in the last couple of years. And so his argument is now would be a good time for Facebook to start thinking about changing the way that they run their business. But I mean, as we've all discussed, we think that's probably impossible.
I think that move to thinking about the world in a better way and is affecting how businesses are. So you can see it in sort of the way that some hedge funds or some big investors are moving money from fossil fuel investment to create the green energy, and they're being pushed by their own LPs and investors, which I think is a way the world's going anywhere. But to think that I don't know how you could get a social media that has been so endemic in the demise of society to change its ways when it's just motivated by making money and selling fucking ads. You know,
I think that, you know, this shareholder value maximization ideology that's referred to is what businesses will no longer be able to do. Like, BlackRock, the investment firm, have come out and said they're going to not put their shareholders, their stakeholders, ahead of purposes. And if companies like that are looking down that way, I mean, whether Facebook would even be allowed to be called a B Corp, because they've just done so much crap in the past that B Corp would just, any kind of, that the would just go like, no, absolutely not. Did you know, anecdote, Havas is a B Corp, for example. So there's B Corp existing in digital media. But like, if you look at the Body Shop, BrewDog, Allbirds, they're kind of big brands globally and in the UK, they are B Corps. You know, some of them, like the Body Shop, have been for a long time. They're their environmental purpose is evident and big. Facebook's environmental purpose will never be that evident. And there is too much bad blood and bad stuff behind them. But as AMS said, like with the upcoming generation that are really conscious of this stuff and really taking it into consideration, are they going to allow Facebook and, you know, by Facebook, we're obviously referring to likes of Instagram and WhatsApp as well, to do the things they've done? Will they talk with their feet, or are they just so entrenched social media doesn't really matter? Because while they are very conscious of this kind of stuff and they're very socially conscious, they're also very obsessed with social media. Will that just block them? Will they turn a blind eye to what Facebook's nefarious practices are so they can carry on doing duck faces?
But Lindsay, how long would that last, right? Because this article made me think of M&S's Plan A. And I don't know if you remember that. Back in 2007, they had their £2 million eco plan where they said that they will change beyond recognition the way it operates over the next 5 years. So 2007 to 2012, they will become carbon neutral. They'll only using offsetting as a last resort. They will ensure that none of their clothing or packaging needs to be thrown away. Much of their polyester clothing will be made from recycled plastic bottles instead of oil. And every year they made a pledge that they will sell over 20 million garments made from fair trade cotton.
How's now, it going?
Exactly. How the hell is it going? Because I don't think they've lived up to it. I know it was an initiative, I think it was the Kyoto Agreement that, you know, the government was driving, but that's just fallen by the wayside. And what's going to change if Facebook probably have a 3-5 year plan, he'll make even more money, and then will he give a shit? I don't know. But unfortunately, they do have, you know, they have a voice. And well, maybe they can make change.
I mean, social media is addictive, right? That's I think the basis of the scenario here is that they have a product that is addictive, and that they make money off via a volume calculation, right? And I just think that internally, the metrics of their monetization model would have to change, and probably the product as well. They would have to find some other way to monetize their product. And I don't know that they're capable of doing that.
No, I think in terms of, you know, the B Corp model specifically, they, you know, have legal standards that companies that are, you know, signed up to be a B Corp have to adhere to, and Facebook are just not going to ever change, you know, their fundamental business documents to say we will put people over profit. I just can't see that happening. But
especially Matt.
I was just going to say, if they did, A, it would be very good for society, and B, it would be wonderful for me personally, because it would probably just mean that Nick Clegg is out of a job, and that's something to celebrate worldwide, I think.
Or I actually had a thought when I was reading it that maybe Nick Clegg might cotton on to this and turn it into his big, you know, lifelong ambition at Facebook and become famous for the person that morphed Facebook into a B Corp. And that would be dreadful because...
Yeah, no, well, knowing his record, he'd change it into a B Corp and then they just suddenly start funding oil spills and just completely go back on it and just fuck it up, really. But
I reckon step one will be put, you know, more plant-based food solutions in their cafeteria.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, well, and you know what else? The TechCrunch article also talks about staff reactions to the way that the company is run and organized. I mean, that could be really powerful if Facebook staff unionize or galvanize themselves in some way and actually really start resisting and pushing back against the organization. That could be interesting.
But how do you change a culture of a company that's completely corrupted? In the top down, right? Mark Zuckerberg could have done a lot more in the last 10 years of this company's existence to stop some of this stuff happening, right? Like, Facebook is probably the most dangerous company on the planet. Never mind the polluters of the planet, right? I think that Facebook is dangerous to democracy, dangerous to sort of civilized society, and it's done everything to exploit the feelings of the human mind, right? And I feel that is unforgivable in many ways. They had paid growth hackers millions in share options to kind of almost like, you know, distort our ape-like minds so it can basically control us into like liking the worst aspects of our humanity so they could sell more fucking ads against it. There's something fundamentally wrong with this company, and I feel it, them trying to pivot to some, you know, socially conscious element is just wrong. Do you know what they should do? Is just close the company down and give all the proceeds to charity. That's what I'd say. I am not a Facebook fan. I never will be. I know I give Google a lot of shit, but I love Google compared to Facebook. Facebook are just pure evil. One of the worst corporations in corporate history, I reckon.
I think you just made a sort of good point. If they were going to change, they'd have done it already. They've had plenty of opportunity to do so and just haven't.
It's endemic, right? Where do they even start?
How do you even start it? Like they have an
particularly when the company is also a massive company like that is controlled. The majority shareholder is the CEO. I mean, says it all.
Yeah,
that was a nice therapeutic rant. I feel all round. Moving on to our third story of the week. The media sales division of Irish broadcaster RTE has created two new research tools dubbed a single audience metric for one RTE, which is incredibly catchy, and understanding audio to improve advertising across their platforms. Head of media sales, Jenny Legg, explained that the first of these tools will serve as a reach and frequency tool that will be able to record a campaign's net reach across multiple platforms while taking duplications into account, a capability which had previously been unavailable to them. The second tool, Understanding Audio, is the product of a research project undertaken by RTE and Red Sea, which focused on the success of ads aired on RTE Radio 1 for listeners aged between 35 and 45. Now, according to Legg, the results provided evidence that radio engenders strong engagement with a positive listening experience, hence creating a high-quality advertising environment, which is in turn boosted by RTE Radio 1's shorter ad breaks. Now, RTE used the radio research findings, including details of what listeners want from a radio program, what they're feeling while listening, and what activities they're engaged in while tuned in, to build the Understanding Audio dashboard. The dashboard apparently gives advertisers insight into where they can find their target audience, thus improving the effectiveness of their campaign. So quite an interesting one in terms of digital transformation and radio advertising as a whole. Rachel, what are your thoughts on this one?
I think that I was interested in particular in the kind of understanding audio tool, because there's not an awful lot of sort of detailed research available around audio channels, certainly not that measures sentiment and I suppose attitudes and intent. And so in that respect, I thought this was kind of, you know, sort of quite groundbreaking to a certain degree. But I wondered how useful a tool. I mean, they talk about the research then being fed into a dashboard, and I just wonder how useful a tool it will be going forward, because, you know, that's quite labor intensive research that they've done. They interviewed people before they listened to audio channels and then after they listened to audio channels, and I just wonder how they're going to, you know, repeat that type of research and make some real sense of it and make some real use of it. But nevertheless, what I also thought is it's definitely giving a sort of a backdrop, I suppose, for brands and marketers to have compelling reasons to start investing in audio as an advertising channel. So I think it's a smart move from RTE, because just as we agreed earlier on, we're going to expect to see brands pushing money into channels that are going to experience quite significant growth in the coming year or so. And audio is definitely one of those channels. The other tool, which was, you know, about sort of measuring reach and frequency across multiple platforms, seems like a really smart move and a sensible thing to do. And again, you know, giving brands a very compelling opportunity to see how their campaigns perform across all the RTE platforms. I don't know where this puts them in comparison to broadcasters elsewhere, because I know that broadcasters in the UK have been doing a lot to try to improve their measurement tools. Like I said, I think the audio thing is something that's maybe a little bit different to what's available in the marketplace here. But I guess the other thing that I think is that the sort of broadcasting landscape is so different in each market. So this is something that looks like a really compelling offer in Ireland. And I can imagine advertisers looking to access that market could think that this is, you know, really useful, and it's got to be beneficial for RTE. But I just wonder what it's like in a bit more of a, you know, sort of disparate broadcasting.
Oh, you almost said developed market there, Rachel.
No. No, Amos, I wasn't saying Ireland is a small country with about 3 people in it, half of which work for Exchange Wire. I wasn't saying that. They're my summary thoughts.
Well, moving to one of the Irish contingent, Amory.
It's interesting. In fairness, I did liken it to some of the kind of anecdotes that Rachel has mentioned previously. When you think about Australia as a testbed, I think it's a good testbed, because you're talking ultimately from the Republic of Ireland anyway, of a population of about just short of 5 million people. So they've got small numbers to work with in comparison to, like Rachel said, different markets, different challenges, different opportunities. It's what I'd like to see is them starting to own some outdoor real estate, you know, because if they can give us figures about year-on-year increases or average dwell times or people watching TV at home and what they're doing in terms of their listening habits and radio, I'd love to see them use that data and information and join it up in terms of when people go outside and what they're doing and how they can kind of create that narrative across the omni-channel, the multi-channel touch points that we, you know, the holy grail that we continuously talk about. That to me would be interesting. The numbers are small, but then who cares? If they're accurate and they're good and they can build on that and they've got a neat offering, brilliant. I'd love to see other organizations, countries learn from what they've done, because like Rachel said, there's a lot to learn from what they're trying to track and what they're trying to measure. The reality of it, I don't know how much more revenue they're going to generate, how compelling it is to brand marketers and advertisers, I'm not sure. But I do think it is, it's food for thought. And I'm really pleased to see an organization of the size. It's got a fair monopoly on the country, but, you know, my only concern is there a bit of a spin on it, because the numbers are small, and are they losing out to streaming, you know, broadcasters? I don't know. The jury's out for me.
Lindsay, what do you think on this one?
Yeah, I think my take on this actually ties in with what AMS is saying about kind of the opportunity of that versus streaming. I mean, there's a stat in the article that radio accounts for 20-25% of all advertising in Ireland, which is high. And it seems to me that Ireland is a nation of radio listeners. Fantastic. But where the opportunity seems to lie for me is not in the radio aspect, but in the digital audio aspect. And the fact that 1% of RTE's audience is player audience, and the rest is made up of radio audience and linear TV audience, tells me that RTE should be doing more work to try to get their users streaming not just their TV, but their radio on RTE player as well, because that would then just give them so much more opportunity to enrich their advertising experience. And there's so much exciting stuff happening in digital audio more generally in Ireland too. Funnily enough, there was an article in the Irish Times written by Dentsu about the opportunities in digital audio in Ireland only a few weeks ago. And that ties in with some of the other stuff RTE could look into outside of your traditional broadcast radio, into the opportunity around streaming and how you target people based on where they are. Because we aren't talking about people listening to their radio in their kitchens or listening to their radios in their car. We're talking about listening to their radios in their phones, and that's where it gets exciting. And that's where I think RTE could have a really good opportunity to try to grow their audience and be able to target them in new and exciting ways. As it stands, I think it's very important that RTE are able to share with advertisers how they can track not just their audience on TV, audience on radio and audience on player, but the overlap between them. That's really important. And that will give advertisers, you know, more opportunity to be able to advertise with them. But beyond that, allowing advertisers to become more creative with radio and what they can do with radio and audio more generally, I think that is where RTE could really see huge opportunity.
Kieran, what are your thoughts on the new tools?
Yeah, look, having grown up in Ireland, radio is hugely important to Irish people. Phone-in shows in Ireland are absolutely huge. I mean, there's a sort of a semi-depressive show just after called The Joe Duffy Show, which basically has everyone's ringing in about how crap their lives are, and Joe just takes great pleasure in getting the worst stories possible on the show. Like, if you don't have
like Elwins for
anybody over, you know, 60 or 70, like, just
old ones.
You don't have a sad, if you don't have a sad story, you don't get on air. But anyway, that's besides the point. So there's a lot of that inventory to monetize. I think if I was to think about this, I think it's a rear guard action. I know for a fact that YouTube is getting shit tons of spend in Ireland, just like it is everywhere else. So I guess on the video side, it's kind of like we need to kind of like tighten up our measurement and tighten up our targeting, so we make it easier for people to kind of like optimize towards, you know, proper KPIs. And the audio piece, it's just a smart move. Consolidate the market before someone else comes in, like a Spotify or even a Google. They have a lot of, they have to protect a lot of spend. Like RT has a dual monetization strategy. So they have the license fee, plus they have the advertising, which there's big controversy at home about, because obviously the BBC in the UK has only got license and there's no ads on the BBC. RT have both, which is, you know, a bone of contention, but they are trying to protect quite a big chunk of money of spend in the market. So this seems like a logical move for them as everything is becoming digitized. And they're getting competition from everywhere. Like, as you pointed out, streaming in Ireland is, you know, just as popular as everywhere else. Its growth has been huge. The Netflix awards, Primes. I would say that RT streaming has been pretty poor, their strategy around that. Really, really shit. If you look at Roku, like, for instance, like, Roku doesn't have an RT app outside of Ireland, which I think is, given that there's probably more people, more diaspora like myself and Anne-Marie and others living outside the country who want to have some kind of like connection to the country, you think that they would have an app on Roku and monetize that, because we're talking about millions of people. It just seems like it boggles my mind how that's not an obvious opportunity for them to do that.
Maybe national, that's difficult for national broadcasters, right? Like, I'm just thinking, okay, the BBC's got a service outside the UK, but it's a different model. So, you know, it's either part of BBC World, which attracts advertising revenue, or it's, you know, the likes of maybe BritBox when they first sort of pulled that together, although I know it's a collaboration between them and ITV and Channel 4. But, you know, other national broadcasters like the ABC in Australia doesn't have any access outside the country. What happens is those programs become available on other streaming services, typically Netflix, actually. But, you know, there's no other access. And I think it's difficult for national broadcasters, because that's a very expensive thing to do.
Yeah, but I'm thinking about news and entertainment, right, as opposed to, like, I mean, a lot of those, like, RT buys a lot of foreign programming in and broadcasts it out. But they don't, like, you can spin up a Roku app pretty easily these days. You can actually, it's not that difficult. If you look at the Roku channels available, there's some real dog shit in there. But you can spin them up pretty easily. I think that there's, is this a kind of need to kind of build something that's similar to Netflix? And I really think that if you, like, RT is never going to go head to head with Netflix. They can on their own programming, but, like, you know, they have an opportunity to do a lot of like light entertainment and news and current affairs, which is kind of what I'm interested in. I don't know, Armory as well, probably. Those things they don't package up very well. But this is probably just the rear guard action about losing money. I can imagine there are losing money to digital channels. You know, Spotify is coming pretty hard for audio, and I'd be worried about that. That would be a huge, that for me, if I was a traditional radio, if that was, I was running a traditional radio advertising business, I would be worried about the likes of Spotify coming in and sucking up any kind of DR based budget around that, like, because you can just put it into Spotify and with first party data, they're able to tell you about who's listened to it, what the action was, all the rest of it. So I think this is more of a rear guard act. It's great to see it, though, that they're innovating.
It is, and that's the thing. But I was curious, you know, what struck me is that they talked about percentages, and I started having a snoop around RTÉ's site to try and get stats. And when they talk about their listeners, they've got over 2 million radio listeners, right, every week. And they say that represents 51% of the adult 15-plus population. But yet, in the figures that they talked about, Matt, I think it was, what, 35 to 45-year-olds?
Yes, yeah.
So they're saying that it's an increase of 26,000 people tuning in since the last release of stats, and it like something like 20,000 more year on year. But it's a weird year. People haven't been able to go anywhere. You know, how are these numbers going to stand up when, I mean, who knows, it might be another year for Ireland, poor things, because they're completely knackered when it comes to getting the vaccination and stuff. But I agree with Ciarán. There's certain things that they can challenge. I do think it's an opportunity. They've got to protect revenue, but I don't know if it's a little bit too late. That's my only concern, based on consumption habits from, you know, a small sample size of the Sidi Mafia clan that are based over there. But you know, even simple things like my sister trying to use the RTÉ player has difficulty.
Yeah, and do you think, in terms of how that technology's come in, is it a case of the, you know, the broadcasters being too slow to implement that? Because obviously, you know, the likes of Spotify and Apple Music, they've been kicking around for a good couple of years now. It's not just like they're here. What do we do? Or is it a case of, you know, the marketers just kind of using radio as a brute force channel and not really going, right, we need the tech to actually have nuanced solutions around this? Or is it just a case of that tech hasn't been there yet?
It's probably driven a lot by, if you're looking at it from a monetization perspective and revenue perspective, it will be driven a lot by advertisers from the perspective of, if they're not looking for new exciting ways to target their target audiences, then why would a broadcaster feel the need to innovate and develop new expensive technology? Very expensive. If you look at kind of what the likes of over here, the likes of Bauer and Global are spending on this kind of tech to kind of deliver on their apps as well as kind of on traditional analog radio, then maybe they're not going to bother, because advertisers are happy and comfortable spending in radio advertising in their usual traditional analog ways, and they get results from it. This measurement will help with that, but this measurement certainly won't make that move any further in terms of transformation. It'll just make radio advertising feel more robust. It won't increase innovation.
But it'll chip away, Lindsay. Like, if I was a legacy company, I would be worried about what's coming down the road, right? Because those media buyers are getting younger and they're getting more digital. Like, if you think about the agency, it's becoming more consolidated around digital first, right? Consolidation, the media planning piece. And if I was a buyer, I'm going, look, or a traditional legacy player, I'd be worried about that. I'm going, you know what? In 3 years' time, I could be innovating around, like, if I don't do something quickly. And I guess maybe that's what's motivating our team. Maybe they've seen something. Maybe they've seen numbers going week, like, you know, each week YouTube and Spotify are increasing revenue, and we're just holding steady. We're not growing. When the market's growing 3%, we're like just stagnant. What happens in 5 years' time when we don't have the capability of delivering what Spotify and YouTube are doing, and the other audio channels that are digitized and have, you know, proper measurement and proper targeting capabilities? So, you know,
the other thing is, it can be partly driven by where marketers are finding the audiences at the moment. And I'd be interested in a breakdown of some of those demographics, because, you know, Lindsay, as you rightly point out, there's an opportunity to sort of increase digital audio audiences. But I wonder how possible that is in a country like Ireland at the moment, with a strong rural population where people probably are driving around in their cars listening to the radio. They probably are at home with the radio on all the time in the background. So maybe there needs to be a bit more sort of behaviour change and cultural change to spur RTÉ on to invest more in digital audio. Or maybe it's going to happen the other way around, which is, of course, your suggestion, Lindsay, that they should try to drive the audiences to those digital channels.
I think it works both ways. I think I read somewhere as well that 20% of the Irish population now has some kind of smart speaker. And even with smart speakers now being involved, like being embedded into phones, even in speakers and headphones, like, that's another way that you can up your digital audio audience quite comfortably, probably without the user even realizing it, because they might then listen to it via Alexa rather than via the traditional Roberts radio or something. I don't know. And that could be one way. I think it needs to be a pronged approach from both sides. Like the marketers and the broadcasters need to encourage it, but also it's just going to be a natural, probably evolving change in consumption as technology evolves, as will the way we listen, whether we even realize it or not.
And the infrastructure, right? Because there's still, you know, I don't know what Wi-Fi coverage is like across the country and internet accessibility. AMS is certainly always complaining that it's not great where.
Oh, no, it's good. It's just that my mother hasn't got it.
And 4G in Ireland's brilliant.
Yeah.
4G
coverage is excellent in Ireland because it's tested.
But isn't this more of a conversation for legacy businesses? RT is very similar to other broadcasters across Europe who are getting eroded by this digitization piece. And they're all having to act. I'm sure that they're all kind of thinking, well, how do I protect my market? Because the reality is, though, most of the kids are not listening to the radio when they're driving. They probably hook in their Spotify into the system and listen to Spotify, right?
It'd be an older demographic that are still tuning in.
Sure, but that's not really where the money's going to be in 10 years' time. This is the problem with legacy entities that, you know, it's almost like it's splintering of media, fragmentation, which is not very, very much in favor of these big behemoth media companies, especially in small markets like Ireland. Like, RT is oversized in our market. Like, it is absolutely huge, you know, to the point where it has such a hold over a lot of spend in the space. And it's almost a protective reflex from them because they're protecting what they have. They can't grow their business because, to Lindsay's point, you got to get these kids or emerging sort of audiences into these new channels. And even people who are in their 30s and 40s have developed new habits about listening to stuff. So we're all listening to podcasts. Very few of us are watching terrestrial on a daily basis. Some of us do, but I'm saying, like, you rarely watch terrestrial every single day. You're usually watching Prime or Now TV or whatever is available in that market. So it's a nightmare for those companies because you've got to rethink the whole process. And when you're a big behemoth, right, and remember, RT is under real close scrutiny because they keep asking for more money from the government. So as well as making all this money, they keep going back to the government with cap in hand. We need more money. And they've got this massive, like, payroll of overpaid D4 marble-speaking gobshites who are on the radio all the time, who get paid hundreds of thousands of pounds, and they're not very good. The lad in the bar in some armpit in Cavan would probably do a better job on the radio than some of these people. So they've got a lot of legacy problems, whereas a digital platform doesn't have those same problems. It's going after the talent, and it can pay top dollar for the talent, you know, and RT can't compete as well. They're almost going for second division type individuals to push the brand, which I think is a problem for them.
I, for one, am looking forward to perhaps some, you know, RTE radio being made available outside the country so I can tune into what's his name's old one's hour.
Joe Duffy. Ah, how does that make you feel? Does it make you feel sad? And it's like, the more tears and the more injuries you've had, like, if the story's not sad enough, Joe's just not going to have you on air. It's a shit story. It has to be like the most depressing.
So it's like X Factor auditions, but for radio.
Oh my God, it is nothing like
without the talent. Yeah. Without the talent.
Oh, the dead grannies, that's second division stuff. Like, you have to go a tier above that. Like, you have to have multiple dead grannies. Like, you know what I mean? You know, it's just not good enough to have like a kind of a vanilla story that I'm doing this for my gran up in the flats there. You know, that doesn't work. you have to watch a relative being stampeded by a bunch of sheep, you know, that kind of stuff. That's tragic enough. Like,
it's ridiculous.
Yeah, well, I think sheep stampedes and hoarding of, you know, dead elderly relatives is probably a fine note to leave this one on. Everyone, thank you all ever so much for joining us, Anne-Marie, Lindsay, Kieran, and Rachel. And obviously, thank you all ever so much for listening.
Thanks, Matt.
Thanks, Matt. Bye.